Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian podcast from the magazine that will never, and I mean never, violate your First Amendment rights. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangue Ward, and special guest star making a triumphant return, Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Good morning, everyone.
Hey, Matt.
Hey.
Howdy.
So I wanted this morning not to dwell on the fact that you can now live in the museum, which is something I learned just before we hit the record button here from Catherine Mangue Ward, the former museum over there near the National Mall. No, instead, I wanted to pull together some seemingly disparate threads out of the headlines from last week, all of them having something to do with politicians and free speech. So here are four headlines. With headline voice, number one, Utah law gives parents full access to teens' social media. It seems that minors will no longer be able to sign up for social media accounts without parental consent and access to passwords. And even then, they'll be barred between 10:30 at night and 6:30 in the morning. Number two, Congress grills TikTok CEO as app faces possible U.S. ban. No big deal, just a service that has something like 150 million active users in America. Let's make it illegal. Number three, Florida decides to extend LGBT school censorship to all grades after all. You can pretty much spin the roulette wheel and land on a Florida free expression case these days, it would seem. And finally, number four, this college president knows the First Amendment protects the drag show he canceled. He just doesn't care. Catherine, I want to start in the spirit of that last headline, as spectacularly written by Reason's own Emma Camp. Have we degenerated into a they just don't care phase of policymaking when it comes to activities that we used to think were kind of covered under the First Amendment? And if so, what happened?
I fear that we are actually in a phase of we just don't care about the whole Constitution with regard to all of our policymaking, and that the First Amendment stuff is just a subset, because, of course, we had the Joe Biden forgiving student loans just because, like, I don't know, he just thought he'd try it and see if that's a thing he can legally do, is the one that stands out the most to me recently, where everyone involved was pretty sure it was not allowed. And then they were like, well, we'll just try. But yes, I think we've got a bunch of these on the First Amendment. And I think a lot of it is being justified by the feeling that we are in a cultural apocalypse, right? Yes, the First Amendment is all well and good when everyone's powdered wig is on straight and we are all just trying to do our best to be upright gentlemen. But now, the Chinese TikTok dances have voided the First Amendment, seems to be kind of the vibe. The ladies with fake boobs in your brunch have made the men with fake boobs in your brunch have voided the First Amendment. That's not how the First Amendment works, but it does seem to be the argument that politicians are making.
Liz, you've had to write about most of these stories. Including the including the TikTok hearings from last week. We on this podcast had talked about various anti-TikTok initiatives a couple of weeks ago. But what did we learn at last week's congressional hearings in particular, and or what did we giggle about the loudest?
Well, first of all, I still haven't forgiven Catherine for making me watch that. It was, they talked a lot about TikTok causing harm, and I was like, TikTok has never made me want to cause harm to myself as much as watching this hearing does. It was just, it was in one sense, very typical for these sort of hearings where they call tech CEOs before them, which is like a lot of cluelessness about how the internet works. My favorite maybe was one rep asked, you know, does TikTok access your home Wi-Fi? And the guy was like, well, you know, if you have it on your phone and your phone is hooked up to your home Wi-Fi. And he's like, does that mean that TikTok can reach into all your other devices in your home?
Does it?
You know, no, obviously. So there was a good dose of that. There was a lot of just, you know, TikTok is ruining our children, and in the same general vein that, you know, people complain about Instagram or any sort of social media. What was different was obviously people are afraid that TikTok is sending U.S. user data to the Chinese, and it was just sort of crazy because no one wanted to listen to the CEO at all. I mean, ostensibly they were there because Chu, the CEO, was going to, you know, talk about how they were protecting U.S. user data with these initiatives to hosted in the US and let third parties look at their code and all of that. But basically, they just wanted to be like, you are a tool of the Chinese Communist Party. Is that correct, sir? And he would say, you know, no, that is not correct. And they'd be like, tell me how you're going to stop being a tool of the Chinese Communist Party. And he'd try to say like, well, you know, I object to the premise of that question. And they'd be like, it's a yes or no question, just answer. So it was very much like them just sort of wanting to hear themselves rant about communists for about half of the hearing.
I mean, nothing wrong with ranting about communism. Nick, it's a yes or no question. I'm kidding. It's not.
I think that the internet should go full Footloose and just ban dancing and let's get it over with, especially for kids. Joe Biden. I could see Joe Biden doing that.
Nick.
And when I say Joe Biden, I mean Joe Biden in air quotes.
Yes.
Because he obviously is being, you know, he's coming out of the same factory that the new John Fetterman came out of.
Audio animatronics. It's still with us. It's never left.
It's one of the great things we still do well in America. Thank you, Walt Disney.
More than a decade ago, Nick, in various joint writing projects that shall remain nameless, you and I used to say to our left of center friends, hey, look, you know, you guys think that you're all about free speech, but really your main party is not. We used to say something kind of similar to our friends on the right, having to do with their actual lived-in commitments to free markets and limited government. Do you get the impression that if we were to, you know, kind of say the same thing now, both sides just say, yeah, that's right, we don't really care about that stuff
anymore? And it is literally, I've had arguments with people, or literally, I've actually had arguments with people who say, you know, we are in a culture war, Matt, and you have to pick a side. You know, there are no libertarians in culture wars or some such bullshit. And so I think, you know, the basic premise of your point that people aren't even making the gesture of like, this is how we work around the First Amendment. This is how we work around incredibly long and still vibrant traditions of free expression and of technological innovation. I find it it's deeply troubling. And I want to add one more example. George Will has a great column from yesterday in the Washington Post that cites Damon Root. But, you know, there is a law against encouraging people to move here illegally, which is going in front of the Supreme Court. You know, so like we have a law which may well be enforced by the Supreme Court saying, you know, if you plausibly, if you say, you know what, you know, America is a great country, everybody should move here, you could be prosecuted for encouraging illegal immigration.
Hey, Nick, no question. Do you think America is a great country and everyone should move here legally or illegally?
Yes, I do. I'm willing to willing to be a prisoner of conscience on that one, Matt.
You have a moral duty.
Luckily, we know a few lawyers who will be standing by to defend you.
Unfortunately, I think all of the lawyers we know that have gone in front of the Supreme Court, they all lose, right?
No,
they tend to lose. We know some winners. You know,
I think I'll defend myself. Circle. Yeah, thank you. Just like Charles Manson, Colin Ferguson, Jack Kevorkian, and they're all winners, you know, in the court of public
legal
opinion.
Scholars, yes. Long recognized for their contributions.
Catherine, annoying libertarians, and I repeat myself, are tend to be fond in moments like this of using the phrase "moral panic" to describe how people are treating all this kind of stuff. But do you think actually that the average Joe or Juanita out there in Liz Nolan Brown's Ohio really care about drag queen TikTok, you know, DEI hour? Or is this more of a kind of politically manufactured moral panic?
I mean, lump me in with the annoying libertarians, baby, because this is a moral panic. It absolutely is.
Yeah.
I do think there are a couple different categories here, and the regular people are, in fact, legitimately kind of concerned about the kids these days on the TikToks. Like, that's a thing that, you know, people see in their everyday lives and recognize is, you know, changing the way that particularly their teenagers, but also their grown ass selves interact with the world and the internet.
Maybe
so I think it's legitimate.
Maybe even more phone than TikTok specific, right? It's just
always scrolling on the phone in the various apps. I think that should be, and really quite easily could be, separated from the drag queen story hour panic, and can and should be separated from stuff like the case that Nick just referenced, which I thought Damon's analysis of was really, really good. Those are different things, and they are not stuff that impacts people's day-to-day lives so far, although they set precedents that potentially could, and that's why you have to fight them when they first emerge. But I think the social media stuff does tap into something real that people are genuinely worried about. The correct response is not the one that Congress is currently or that the executive branch is currently hinting that they will pursue.
Liz, you button it, Gillespie, for half a second and come back to it.
There you go.
But no, I wanted to get into a thing that most people didn't realize at the time, but you wrote about spectacularly and often, which is the FOSTA and SESTA laws that were passed a couple of years back. You will explain what those acronyms mean, because I don't want to, and don't know. But the laws back then, in the guise of stopping sex trafficking, were just sort of blatantly anti-First Amendment. And I think we're just up against an anniversary of various prosecutions of Backpage, which spun out of a newspaper company, essentially. Can you talk about that? Or do you even think that this is kind of the antecedent, the canary in the coal mine when it comes to these types of, hey, we don't care if this is obviously violating the First Amendment, we're just going to pass it and do it anyways?
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot in common. First of all, as you mentioned, we're coming up next week on the five-year anniversary of the Fed shutting down Backpage, classified website, and arresting a bunch of the executives. And they've been going through this prosecution now for 5 years with, like, the prosecutors trying all sorts of weird, dirty tricks. And it's just been, them sort of blatantly disregarding the Constitution left and right in process of this. They actually were just arrested for violating the Travel Act by allegedly facilitating prostitution by letting escorts and such post on their ads. FOSTA, which is the Fight Online, Allow States and Victims to Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act. Talk about a loaded bill name there. Makes it a federal crime for a website to promote the prostitution of others. So it was said that it was needed to take down sites like Backpage, although it clearly wasn't, because it was passed after Backpage was shut down. But there's a group of people that have been challenging FOSTA, including the Internet Archive and the Woodhull Sexual Freedom Foundation. And they've been, saying that they're objecting on First Amendment grounds that, what does it mean to promote prostitution? Does that mean that people arguing for prostitution decriminalization are promoting prostitution of others? Does that mean anybody who provides, advice on how to keep sex workers safe is promoting prostitution and things like that? So they've been objecting on First Amendment grounds. And when I was talking to some of the lawyers involved in that case, they specifically brought up the case that Nick mentions, because they said it's very analogous that, it's sort of the same thing. What do these sort of vague statutes, promoting things or aiding and abetting? That's actually been a big thing in a lot of the abortion laws right now too. A lot of the state and city abortion laws have been fighting over what it means to aid and abet abortion, because there's a lot of language against that. And people are worried, does that mean if you refer someone to where they can get an out-of-state abortion, are you aiding and abetting abortion? Is that a crime? So yeah, I think that all of these things, they appear very different, at first, but they're all sort of rooted in this same thing, which is attempts to criminalize speech that can get around the First Amendment, I think, because in all of these cases, they argue, no, it's not speech we're criminalizing, it's conduct. But essentially, it is speech that they're trying to criminalize in all of these cases.
Or they argue it's not speech that we're criminalizing, it's we're just, helping others moderate speech in a totally legitimate and not First Amendment violating way. Like, this is all the jawboning and all that, where, I think you actually started the segment by saying, like, maybe they don't even care about the First Amendment anymore, but they do. They still write in the little workaround. They're still always kind of looking to give themselves cover. It's just they're not honoring the spirit.
One of the ways to think about this is, it isn't about specific laws. It's about a kind of general kind of social cloud of sentiment and feeling and temperament. And it's, you know, I think a lot about this in terms of after World War II in the 50s, you know, the Constitution hasn't really changed. The interpretation of it has. And it was so much harder to speak freely. People were, you know, criminally prosecuted for things like obscenity, you know, stand-up comics, people like Allen Ginsberg and whatnot. And, you know, that changed because there was a core group of people who pushed for free expression in the name of the First Amendment and free speech. And like the American value is kind of free speech and free assembly, right? And freedom of religion, which is a way of, you know, being able to live how you want, as long as you're not hurting people. And what's, you know, what's different now, like they won. By the end of the 50s, the laws had changed substantially so that, you know, books like Tropic of Cancer and Lady Chatterley's Lover and even Ulysses, which couldn't be published legally in America without being threatened with, legal action, suddenly were available, you know, only, you know, 20 to 40 years after they had been written. Nowadays, what is deeply worrying to me is that we're back into this censorial mindset where, you know, there's a confusion of speech with action or conduct. There are all sorts of things where it's like, well, we're helping the feeble people. We're helping kids. We're helping, religious minorities who are persecuted, et cetera. And what was different in the past when free speech was expanding was that, you know, the left was very pro-free speech for a lot of reasons, many of them, you know, not particularly good motivations. It was, you know, communists who were really loyal to Stalin didn't want to get arrested, but it worked to the common good. We don't have that coalition right now. When you look to the right and the left, they are both all about controlling and regulating speech, just like controlling and regulating the economy or the borders and things like that. And this is where I think libertarians are the last, you know, this is a place where we're the remnant. And we, you know, it's bad being a remnant. We need to figure out who our allies are and to build back a coalition that says, fuck it. You know, it's like, you know, America is nothing if not the First Amendment. And really build out a kind of legal, ultimately illegal and then ultimately social and cultural change that moves into a world of, you know, permissionless innovation or permissionless living. And I was reading Jerry Tuccilli has a newsletter that people can subscribe to at Reason. It's free, called The Rattler. And it was about occupational licensing. And, you know, the key line or the subhead was something like, you shouldn't need permission to make a living. And it's like, that's totally right. And that applies to every aspect, especially speech and peaceful free assembly. And like, that's, we need to build out that coalition.
Nick and I have both, and other people on staff have talked over the years about the twin facts of, we think facts at least, of the Supreme Court being really good this century on free speech. And also that the Supreme Court, as Barry Friedman has argued pretty persuasively, tends to lag and ratify public opinion 10 years after the fact. And so this the worry about the culture of free speech, which is a thing that exists no matter what people with funny hats tell you, if the culture of free speech goes bad, then we worry that the Supreme Court's ratification 10 years later, it will also start being bad itself. One sort of addendum to that is just the notion, because we've talked about free speech and the Supreme Court in this context, they only hear so many cases a year. You know, if everyone's out there just throwing out laws and going to ban this and do that, state level, local level, federal level, you're going to be a bit overwhelmed. You can't stop that. You can't just rely on the Supreme Court being the backstop on all of this. If you don't change around the culture, including the political culture, you're going to see a lot more of the FOSTA SESTA-ization of everyday life out there. And it's no good, Catherine, is what I'm saying. All right. I wanted to switch topics here. This next one is the direct result from the mistake I made in visiting the Washington, D.C. office.
It was great to have you in the office
this past week. Fun fact, by the way, we have a new office in D.C. being finalized right now. And from what I understand from a snappy little brochure that arrived in my mailbox the other day, you can pledge and support like walls and bookcases and windows and things like that. So go check.
A couple of the toilets are already claimed, but there are other naming rights still available.
The Gillespie Memorial Toilet is.
Please reach out to you know, Matt Welsh personally about those naming rights.
How that goes. Anyways, I was there and I said, "Hey, Catherine, isn't it great that I can just be here and we could talk like in person? So maybe you want to have some input on what the Reason Roundtable is going to be talking about." And sadly, she answered and she said, "Great, let's talk about why you, Matt Welch, are so wrong about hating on ChatGPT and artificial intelligence and all that stuff." So here we are. I will set it up. I don't know when it got started. I think in the last couple of months, suddenly something like 25% of my Twitter feed and certainly the Reason Slack channel just got clogged with people experimenting with like telling a robot how to write poetry, like, you know, James Joyce punching Muhammad Ali or something like that. I was all sweet. I can now just turn off my brain and ignore 25% of all conversation and instead focus even harder on Biff Pokoroba statistics. Some other people who are a little bit darker than I in their ludism have been worrying loudly about Skynet and machines learning from each other and whatnot. Catherine insists that I and they are all wrong, that the robot chat birds are awesome, and we should really spend all of our time telling our illustrators to make George Washington look like a professional wrestler. So Catherine, please tell me why I am wrong. And also why the fearmongers are wrong too, and that this is super interesting to watch Jesse Walker use ChatGPT in the Slack channel.
I cannot definitively say whether the fearmongers are right or wrong yet, but what I can say is that right now is the fun part, and you are missing out on the fun part by being a curmudgeon. All of these new things are like weird and mushy and just generating unexpected things. And that is the best part of a new technology. And, you know, just getting in there and messing around, like what you're seeing is the kind of the products of people experiencing this thrill of something genuinely new. And you can be a grumpy old man about it, I guess, if you want. But why wouldn't you join us as we experience the thrill of something genuinely new? I have in the past couple of weeks used ChatGPT for a whole bunch of different things, including I asked it to recommend drinks for all of us here on the pod. And it did a shockingly good job picking an old fashioned for Suderman, a margarita for Matt, a gin martini for me. And Nick, I asked it to recommend psychedelic drugs for you. And ChatGPT said, I cannot in good conscience recommend psychedelic drugs because they might be illegal. So that was some bullshit, but that was fun too. And Liz, I'm sorry, I didn't know you were going to be filling in for Suderman today, but you can have his old fashioned, you save it for later. But, I also had it write an introduction. I had to introduce a speech given by Robbie Suave. I had it write it for me, and it did a much better job than I would have, frankly. And I just think, like, be in the fun part of this. Like, be in the part where it's disruptive and weird. And also, like, this is going to solve a bunch of the problems that we currently have with the last round of technology. And I think that that's something that's really underappreciated. Like,
how is this going to solve something?
In the same way that, we are like right now freaking out about the fact that, our search engines are run by the left or the right or whoever, and our social media is, too absorbing of our teenagers. Like, when the AIs pop in here, it's all going to change again. Like, TikTok isn't going to be the dominant platform in a couple of years because it's all going to change again. And I think that it's just like, this is a new technology sweeping in with the gale of creative destruction at its back. And we like that. Remember? We like that.
Yeah.
We are in favor of
but
that.
But it's already getting roped into those sort of cultural war battles that, like, the stuff you just mentioned is. Like, already people are mad because, like you said, like, it won't recommend illegal drugs. Or I guess, like, one of the things, maybe ChatGPT wouldn't write an ode to Donald Trump. And, like, they've been programmed
by tech
companies, too.
They're competing ones.
Yeah.
And to, you know, drill down on Catherine's sense of fun and wonder, let's put it in the show notes, but Twitter handle Cherry Teresa has an AI-generated Glenn Danzig hates the DMV as much as we do. And look at these pictures. This is fun. It's interesting. There is an entire world of art, music, literature that is being born with this. And instead of wetting our pants about it, we ought to, you know, kind of engage it a little bit and see where it's going and what it's about. One of the big stories last week, Matt, that, you know, had people scared were there were AI generated pictures of Donald Trump being arrested. And the Washington Post wrote about it and didn't show the pictures, you know, because that's, that would be like committing a crime or something like that. But the response to it was fascinating. And it's like, what is happening is AI, and it's not just making, you know, pictures or doing stuff. It's AI helps to get rid of the grunt work. So, you know, every time you use a cell phone answering, you know, when you leave a message or you use a vacuum or you use any labor-saving device that gets rid of the grunt work, that's what AI is mostly going to be doing. It's going to be doing coding. It's going to be doing background stuff to free us up to live the lives, you know, at a higher level, not at, you know, we're not going to become slaves to this. But we will develop, and we are already developing, the media literacy that goes in a world where essentially everything can be assumed to be some sort of deep fake. And that is true of the way we live and our life philosophies. We all, you know, we have random kind of connections to reality that sometimes we test, sometimes we don't. AI kind of manifests that in a bigger way. And it boggles my mind that people are, you know, afraid of this. And the fact is it's not people, it's experts. And, you know, Suderman actually flagged this for discussion. Over the weekend, Yuval Harari and a couple of other people have this incredibly insane rant against AI called "You Can Have the Blue Pill or the Red Pill, and We're Out of Blue Pills." And it's about how if we don't master AI, it will master us. And it's like, you know, the fucking history of technology is that it serves humans. And if you don't believe that, you know, go back before the Industrial Revolution. The technologies that stick inevitably increase the quality and standard of human living. I mean, and there's like a really good track record of that. And when they don't, they get squeezed out, they don't get adopted, or they do ultimately, you know, get disfavored in a way that they go away. It's mind-boggling. I shouldn't say it's mind-boggling to me. It's incredibly depressing to see how quickly stuff that's coming out that actually is the most interesting technology and the most optimistic and forward looking that we've seen in a couple of decades. People are already just roping it in and, you know, trying to stamp it with the dumbest culture war and technophobia that, you know, has been dominating in much of this century.
But isn't there a category difference between, you know, automation of something? Oh, my God, they built an assembly line. It's going to take us out of work, and machines learning from themselves. I think that's
yeah,
the thing.
They're
that's,
not though. I mean, yeah. This is the whole thing of like, you know, they don't master language yet. And again, what's important is, you know, that we develop the critical faculty to understand what it's like when you live in a world of, you know, machine generated images of the world, which is not, I don't think it's categorically different than living in the past of, you know, Descartes' vision of the world or Darwin's vision of the world or, you know, Edgar Allan Poe's vision of the world. I mean, we live in a mediated world, and this makes the mediation, it gives end users more control ultimately. And we have to own that and then start developing, you know, the psychology and the literacy skills that will allow us to exploit it to our advantage and not be suckers.
Liz, I feel like I should ask you a question that includes the phrase revenge porn deepfakes. I don't really know what any of those words mean, but it seems like you'd be the expert.
You just did it. Congratulations.
Yeah, that's the new panic that people are going to use this technology. And one of the many new panics, I guess I should say, that people are going to use this technology to make fake porn videos of people. And that's the worst thing that could possibly, there's like a lot of people who believe that's the worst thing that could possibly happen with this is that, you know, your face might be inserted into a porn video. I also think it's interesting too. I saw for the first time today, Freddie DeBoer, who's like, you know, a socialist writer, his friend of mine, but he's usually good on civil liberties and culture stuff. Usually he had a very panicky newsletter post about how, you know, people are talking about how you can use ChatGPT to automate your sort of like responses to like form email, dumb emails, or like, you know, chats with your colleagues that are like not very important. And he's freaking out. Like, this is just part of like people avoiding, you know, talking to other human beings, and, you know, you order your food from an app and then you watch your videos on YouTube. And blah. I was like, oh God, this is going
to, you don't go to the toll operator anymore. Right. You know, you have EasyPass. Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. It's going to get lumped into what is generally, I guess, a conservative complaint about like, oh, you know, we're not having this human connection and stuff anymore. And I was like, I hadn't seen that yet. And so that's yet another dumb culture war battle that this is going to,
you know, if I may, just to talk about, you know, AI generated or deepfake revenge porn, et cetera, like, and I think we've talked about something similar to this, Matt, like, you are old enough, like me, to remember, you know, when a nude photo shoot from, you know, a future star's lean model days was enough to destroy a career or dethrone Miss America. And what has happened with the proliferation of nudity, both, you know, consensual and non-consensual. And I'm not saying anybody should be posting this stuff or, you know, or seeing it without the consent of everybody involved. But it's that we no longer freak out. Miss America in the 80s would be dethroned because she had taken a bunch of like art shots. You know, that's not going to happen now. And in fact, we live in such a better world. Nobody even gives a shit about Miss America anymore. Like, you know, if you start producing more stuff of dubious value, people value it less and they move on. I think, it, you know, and that's a fantastic liberating thing, not just for women and sexuality, but for like, you can apply it to everything. And it's just like, we shouldn't be freaking out about this. And the people who are, and it's interesting that Liz brings up somebody like Freddie DeBoer, because he is a exemplary leftist of a certain sort, but he's fundamentally conservative because people like the way the world is now, especially if they're doing pretty well in it. And, you know, so they're panicked that they're not going to be the priests of this next world or something like that. This, you know, it's the printing press over and over again.
Or maybe he just thinks it's weird for people to send out writing that they didn't write. I get that.
But also,
you know, what are you responding to? You know, it's
I think the deepfake thing too.
I think having robots.
I was just gonna say the deepfake thing too. I mean, as Nick mentioned, if people would actually start widespread like making deepfake revenge porn of people, it would be better, because then, I mean, not better, but it would be probably easier than it is today if someone did it, because, you know, if this becomes a common thing, then it's just like, that's not really me. And everyone will accept that because we all know that technology,
you know, with the Apple
there.
iCloud hack, there were, you know, literally, you know, thousands, if not millions of pictures that were, you know, hacked and distributed, you know, and the most viewed ones were of known, you know, big actors and things like that. And they didn't suffer, you know, and they suffered psychological damage, which is understandable. We'll change that too. No, it's not. I'm not saying it's great, but
a bunch of like Nick Gillespie porn in the world. That's not.
No, but what is great is that like nobody's career was destroyed over this. This was, and like we move on, and now nobody cares about that kind of stuff. So it's like, you know, the whole fear of like, we're going to have a technology forced on us that doesn't enable us to live a better life. Where did that happen exactly? And then you start falling back. Oh, well, the assembly line, the factory, the city. And it's like, you know, if you want to argue, you know, that technology is something that is forced on humans and then we're yoked to it and we become, you know, it's the matrix. Yeah, go ahead. You know, live that life. And you can do it now without AI. And there are whole ideologies, you know, from the far left and a Marxist ideology to a far right one that goes with that. And, you know, meanwhile, I think the rest of us will be enjoying ourselves using technology so that we have more time to actually think and love and learn and you know, have interesting lives.
I will submit that if I stumble upon, by accident, by just happenstance, a deepfake Nick Gillespie porn, that I will suffer damage. That will be, I don't. That will not.
I'm sure you will.
I'm sure you seem to have forgotten.
I think you'll be in it.
You seem to have forgotten the brief period many years ago when our comments were taken over by erotica,
yes,
featuring all of the Reason staff. only written, not imaged.
I have chosen not to remember that or even acknowledge
the phrase, but. Nick hung his leather jacket on a nearby stalactite is a phrase that I will never ever.
Oh, dear God. All right, that's enough robot tree for now. Let's get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, do you really know yourself? I mean, your real self, not your robot self. Are you the same person that you were 10 years ago? Or I don't know, February 2020? To pick a month. If your inner machinery has indeed been changed by the challenges of time and circumstances, have you adjusted your self-conception and operating system accordingly? Therapy with a trained and independent arbiter can be a worthwhile way of deepening your sense of self-awareness, allowing for changes to the way you approach things and just coping better with the obstacles that all of us face. That's where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many, many listeners of this very fine podcast that you're listening to. All you do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist, then start increasing your self-knowledge right away. Discover your potential with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/roundtable today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. Go there today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder to email us your snappy queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes once again. I think this is not the first crime from Larkin Hogel, just because I remember the name, who writes.
Oh, Larkin.
Once again, Larkin Hogel, you foil me. Who writes, hello, Roundtable. Rand Paul recently tweeted, quote, a Trump indictment would be a disgusting abuse of power. The DA should be put in jail, end quote. The Paul name means a lot in libertarian circles, but does Rand Paul still have any libertarian principles, Catherine Mangue Ward?
He does. I mean, let's give credit where it's due. He absolutely rolls up every year and tries to end as many wars as possible. He absolutely, does have still the muscle memory of some of these libertarian principles, and I'm sure hold them sincerely. Here's the thing that's not libertarian: putting people in jail for dubious legal theories. That's not a thing we do. I actually think, the more that I read about the Trump indictment, the more I think that it's really quite a tenuous and tendentious case that they are bringing against him, even if, in fact, it does go forward. But we can't, we don't fight fire with fire. That's the thing we don't do in the criminal justice system as libertarians. And I think we should not listen to Rand Paul in this case, even though sometimes he is still libertarian.
I mean, if you're going to put anyone in jail, why not the state, man? Yeah. Nick?
Yeah, why not Fauci? You fight fire with fire and the world is blind, Matt Welch. The world is blind.
Did the robot write that for you?
Yeah, I'm hoping. I mean, for me, the deficit in AI is I want an AI that consumes all this stuff so that I no longer have to. But we'll get there.
This is the theory. This is the beautiful theory of AI, is that it's going to take care of all of the worst parts of human interaction. And
including this podcast.
Yeah,
right?
Of course, this is why I like it. This is why I like it, Matt.
No, I mean, it is the difference of
sending
easy pass.
Great thanks back to an email.
You are the last.
I want a robot to do that.
You're the only person out there listening to this. Sadly, it's probably not even true, but who likes the COVID era, I don't have to touch a menu anymore. I'm just going to mediate it through my little
phone. What a loss. What a loss to civilization that we use QR codes. Like, who fucking cares? Like, if that is where you stand, Matt Welch, that's, you're in the church doorway, because I want a filthy menu in my hand at a cheap Mexican joint in Brooklyn. There'll be a place for you. There will still be places like that, Pat.
This
we'll carve out a little prisoner village for you.
That they warned me about with you cosmetarians.
No, it's true.
Who's supposed to answer this question?
I was going to suggest that we may have reached a point, and this might be related to AI, but where Jake Paul is more libertarian than Rand Paul. Oh, and that is a little bit disturbing. But Rand Paul, I think, is a force for good overall in the Senate. But he, if we're not mincing words, and we shouldn't, he is not presenting as the, as the next iteration of a libertarian Republican Party that I think he did before Donald Trump became president. And that has nothing, we're not even talking about the specific indictment against Trump, which does sound like bullshit. And even, I would go so far as to say, even if Trump is guilty of lesser crimes, given the fact that he's a former president, you have to take that into consideration when you bring action against somebody. There's always discretion in prosecutions. And like, you know, it's never a good look when you start prosecuting former elected officials over, you know, minor things, if that's what's going on here.
And,
but
and prosecutorial immunity, get behind that one. Liz, what say you about the Rand Paul perplex?
I just basically the same thing that Nick and Catherine said. He's, you know, very libertarian on some things, very unlibertarian on others, still more libertarian than most people in Congress, or maybe, you know, almost anyone, but that's a very low bar.
I, to get Nick's ears interested, again, I wrote a piece in 2015 called The Earl Weaver Case for Rand Paul's Libertarianism, which is great because
so it's a bad case.
Nick hates Earl Weaver because Nick, this is a big surprise to everyone.
Little punk who died in on a cruise ship, Matt Welch. He died on a cruise ship that the reason Magazine Cruise was on one year.
A Hall of Fame baseball manager, Earl Weaver, who everyone except Nick Gillespie says is a great manager. The one thing that he would do as a manager is, and it was actually kind of a revolutionary insight for the moment, is that he would take a flawed player and, in his words, learn to accept them not for what they can't do, but for what they can do. In other words, put them in situations where they're good at, yank them out of situations that they're bad at, and then suddenly a lot of people who had been discarded by other organizations because they weren't the complete package could be put in positions to succeed. And his teams did really well for 17 years or however long he managed. And
wait, are we talking about Rand Paul now? Or are we talking about AI? Because honestly, lessons apply.
And now I'm thinking of Rand Paul, who actually is pretty good at baseball. Congressional
I'm not sure
baseball
as good
games.
As good as Ron.
Ron Paul,
home
run, but they're both
Astros
good.
Uniform.
They're both, yeah.
Both pretty good for for little fellas. Ron's not so big. But anyways,
A little Freddie Patek.
There was a when Rand Paul ran for president in 2014-15, very unsuccessfully. But there was a ton of commentary, including in Reason and other places, that were like, he's not the real libertarian, you know, like just he's a disappointment to us all. And that's fine. I just want to make the Earl Weaver case, which is like, hey, look, he actually does more libertarian stuff than almost everybody. And I want people to the extent to which we're going to have any senators. I prefer that they have more libertarianism than not libertarianism. This is a scattering of headlines about Rand Paul over the last week. Rand Paul introduces amendment to repeal 2001 authorization for the use of military force. That's good. Rand Paul opposes new bill to ban TikTok. That's good. Rand Paul laments overclassifications of documents in hearing for archives nominee. Good. Cory Booker and Rand Paul file revised bill to reschedule psychedelic breakthrough therapies for Nick Gillespie. Also good. So, like, yes, you can submit him to a litmus test, and yes, you could just criticize him because you should criticize everybody who's in power, obviously. And also, it's worth pointing out that he does some libertarian stuff still, and that's worth continuing to talk about.
Would you trade him, though?
For who?
Would you trade him, Matt Welch?
For John Lowenstein?
Because as he lived up, he was a round one draft pick, man. You know, he was a franchise player. Is he still a franchise player?
You know, the standards have been debased, and there hasn't been a more libertarian person come through since he joined the Senate. And now he's the chair of the Senate or the leading Republican, ranking Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. That's helpful. I'd rather have that, even though I don't necessarily agree with everything he says on the Foreign Relations Committee either. Okay, enough of me talking. Let's get to our close of podcast discussion of what we have been consuming in the cultural arena. Nick, why don't you lead us off?
Now I have to actually go and find my thing. Yeah, I know. I forget. I consume a lot of shit every week. What did I say?
Again, oh, yeah, here it is. I, for one, welcome our robot overlords who can do these recommendations for us by scraping our Kindle and streaming service data.
I want some control over that. Yeah. You know, AI revenge porn. Earl Weaver revenge porn, where he's being victimized by Joe Altobelli, Matt Welch, a guy who could reliably win the World Series. Okay.
To produce some Earl Weaver revenge porn just for you guys.
Yeah. So I watched Money Shot, the Pornhub story, which is a documentary on Netflix. It's not very dirty. I guess there's a few nipples, but that's about it. It's pretty family friendly, Matt, especially if you know you belong to the Manson family. But it is a discussion of how Pornhub was broadly demonized. And it talks about kind of the, you know, weird financing of it and things like that. And it has, unfortunately, it has an arc. It's interesting as just as how Pornhub kind of grew and how it intersected and really revolutionized. And according to some people, decimated the porn industry, while also because it made it harder for traditional kind of legacy porn producers to monetize their content. But by the same token, it also allowed individuals to do that quite successfully, as well as kind of create, a market for things like OnlyFans and other stuff. But it's about a crusade against porn and to shut down Pornhub as a den of trafficking and underage exploitation. And there's a reveal about the crusade against it, which is unconvincing and ultimately uninteresting. I won't spoil it. But I think watching Money Shot, the Pornhub story, is an interesting addition to this question about free expression that has been haunting us like Banquo's ghost. This episode, Matt Welch.
Liz, what have you consumed?
I am rereading right now a book by Joan Kennedy Taylor. It's called Reclaiming the Mainstream Individualist Feminism Rediscovered. Feminists for Liberty, which is a nonprofit libertarian feminist group that I help lead. We're doing our first book club and we're reading that. So I read it years ago and I'm rereading it. And it's just really good. Taylor was she was a longtime Libertarian Party activist. She was worked with Ayn Rand when she became friends with her when she worked at a publishing house. She went on to help found the Association of Libertarian Feminists and Feminists for Free Expression in the 90s. So this book was written in 1992 or 1993. And it's partly about waves of American feminism and how, there's always been a push and pull between individualist feminism or libertarian feminism and more collectivist or socialist feminism. And she argues that, at time periods when libertarian feminism has been more ascendant, it's appealed to a broader range of the American public and feminism has gotten a worse rap and been sort of less powerful and less, mainstream when it's been the sort of collectivist sort that's in charge. And, when she was writing in the 90s, the collectivist sort was in charge. And unfortunately, that is still true. So it's really interesting for a historical perspective on feminism and libertarian feminism specifically. And also because, sadly, like a lot of the things she's writing about from the early 90s perspective are still very much true today.
Catherine,
could I ask you very quickly, Liz, are you finding a rebirth of interest in individualist feminism or, kind of pro-capitalism or anti-left-wing collectivist feminism in your circles?
We definitely have a lot of people who are already libertarians who are excited to find that sort, that there is like a whole history of this. Amongst like other people who consider themselves feminists and are not libertarian, no.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I consumed a book in my favoritist genre, which is the How a Single Commodity Explains Everything nonfiction book genre. And this book is called Egg. It's by Lizzie Stark. It's out this week. It's a new book. It's out this week. The subtitle, God Help Us All, is A Dozen Overtures. And it is,
God.
And it's.
And you roll your eyes when we talk about the Baltimore Orioles salad days.
And I will continue to do so until my dying day. Book is very interesting. It is also well timed, right? You know, you hear about people write books and they're like, oh, is it going to be published too late, too early? This book is landing on shelves right as everyone's like, why are my eggs so expensive? Blah, blah, blah. So good timing. Congratulations to Lizzie Stark on that. There was like just a bunch of cool stuff in here that I didn't know, including like how many creation myths are egg based, and also a whole history of people who used to be egg collectors because they thought that like eggs contained the evolutionary missing links that were going to like fill in the gaps in Darwin's work. So people were like constantly risking their lives to steal eggs from rare birds, which turned out to be completely useless. Just like a bunch of stuff about like eggs use in science. I will put an asterisk on this for a reason, roundtable listeners. The book's a little woke. And in particular, the first page of the book has a note that not all people with ovaries are women and not all women have ovaries. And so when we talk about eggs and ovaries in this book, we're going to always use gender neutral pronouns. And you know what? I'm fine with that. That's fine. But it's literally like the first thing in the book. And there's a bunch of other spots where she like celebrates the throwing of eggs at a statue of Margaret Thatcher and stuff like that. I am perfectly happy to overlook that sort of thing because this book has
overlook.
Yes. I'm going to overlook it because this book has really just a bunch of great stuff in it. But if that is going to be too much for you, you should give this book a pass. I think you should read it, though, if you enjoyed great previous classics such as Salt and Cod and also all those other books where one thing explains everything.
Thimble.
Because I don't think that exists. But I think you have your next,
it does
your
now,
next book
somewhere,
project.
ChatGPT.
Nick,
yeah. Matt, if I may, I was gonna, Catherine, do all rooster, like, are all chickens that lay eggs, are they all female or is there, is there confusion?
We do not know about the subjective experience of gender as it is experienced by most birds, just because they're not great at communicating that. I don't know if people have ever asked, like, some of them talky birds, like, you know, the parrots and stuff, what they feel about their gender. I assume like Matt Walsh is like vaulting over. He's like running toward us so that he can ask a parrot, what is a woman? And then we'll find out. But
the reason I bring it up is, Matt, because my dead ex-father-in-law was involved in creating a mascot for a single-A baseball team that was called Rosie the Red. And it was a rooster who cross-dressed and acted like Pete Rose, Charlie Hustle.
Oh. M-G.
So there was the gender confusion in single A, and like for the Portsmouth Pioneers.
I am
for a brief period of time.
To process the information that you just put into my ears.
And I am here for that, Ooh. Catherine, because there's me, Matt, and maybe half another listener somewhere who will understand any of that.
Yeah, there's a, I discovered, retweeted, and then Greg Lukianoff bought a t-shirt of a 19th century Shenandoah minor league team called the Shenandoah Hungarian Rioters. That was a name of a minor league team. Rioters, like you're going to riot all over your face there in Shenandoah. It's fantastic. Nick, can you sing with me the egg jingle, which is one of our very best.
The incredible edible egg?
The incredible edible egg. Ding. Yeah, really good. Much better than the almond.
Egg is a contested food, right? I'm sure the author goes into
it.
Right?
Is it good for you? Is it bad for you? It's giving us all heart disease. It's the only thing you can eat.
Does she go into egg beaters complicated food. At all? Like do the simulation of egg and egg-like products?
I'm going to do mine now and just interrupt Nick.
I just can't imagine.
For a timely movie here, because it's about a Luddite middle-aged man and his dysfunctional family.
The Matt Welch
four.
Story?
It's called The Mitchells versus the Machines. It's a 2021 film, Netflixed, directed by Mike Rianda, music by Mark Mothersbaugh, Nick.
Of
Devo fame.
Yeah, the prophet of de-evolution. Yeah, we're all becoming Wink Martindale.
It's about a family four who becomes humanity's last hope against the robots who have decided to enslave everybody because artificial intelligence is bad, and the dad was right about that being the Luddite, and it's. I watched it at the behest of my 8-year-old, who spent a lot of time laughing and pointing at me, which was interesting. There's quite a few laugh out loud moments, especially of the dad's inability to do things like log on YouTube, which I totally get. It was pretty great. It's silly. It tends to be kind of a tender, affectionate look at familial dysfunction. And of course, they ended up all going great. And then without spoiling too much, but there is the requisite, the addled peacemaking mom at some point becomes a enraged, little bear cub protecting superhero avenging against all the robots. And it's all kind of fun. So it's the Mitchells versus the Machines. You can find it on Netflix, probably other venues as well. But pretty good. Pretty good. And it fits this episode very nicely. So there you go. Let's talk about the things that we talk about at the end of the show, which we have a lot of announcements. It's very exciting here. If you go to reason.com/events, you will see certainly at least two announcements, but probably a third. The third is one I'll talk about right now, which is that we're going to do the Reason Roundtable live, people, in New York. City on April 25th. Hear that grunt of satisfaction?
Yeah.
That is so we're gonna do that.
Computer generated.
AI deep fake porn grunt from Gillespie.
It's gonna be like that time when Kraftwerk appeared in concert, but it was just mannequins and the music was beamed in via satellite from Germany, Matt.
That's what it's all about. Anyways, yeah. So go there for ticket information. It'll be an evening, the Village Underground, April 25th. It's going to be great. And look forward to it. But tickets are limited, so you'll want to jump on that as soon as it is available. There is also the April 3rd Reason Speakeasy event,
yes.
Nick, that you want to tell them more about again.
Yeah,
go.
That is with Matt Zwolinski and John Tomasi, the authors of the book The Individualist, which is an intellectual history of the libertarian movement and where it's heading, but maybe shouldn't be. So, excuse me, that's April 3rd. The Reason Speakeasy tickets are $10, and doors open at 6 p.m. There's beer, wine, food, and mostly conversation for the mind, Matt Welch.
Yes. And also, very excitingly, we have this podcast has a new YouTube channel, The Reason Roundtable itself. Go to youtube.com/@, you know, the little at, Reason Roundtable. And there's even video footage of a podcast that we did that I was not involved in. So I don't really recognize it as legitimate. But you can go there and check it out. That's not...
Yeah, it's not canon, Matt Welch. It's not canon.
It's headcanon. This is not a promise that we're going to start showing regularly video of this particular podcast, because I'm not quite committed yet to wear pants and such like, but it's for those of you, and I know there's many of you who like to consume audio on YouTube, this is the way to do it. It's great. Should be fun. So youtube.com/ReasonRoundtable, do it, you'll be glad you did, etc. If you like our business, contribute to it, please. Reason.com/donate gets you there. Catherine, am I leaving out anything else?
Just that one sentence that I said on this podcast was actually a robot-generated version of me, and listeners should try to guess which one it was.
Dear God.
My God.
Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Oh man! Oh God! Oh man! Oh God! Oh man!